tell me something. Have you ever rolled down your window at a gas station to catch some hot whiffs? While pumping gas, have you ever spilled a few drops on your shirt for some free takeout smell? Baby, I know you're with me, because you know that the smell of gasoline is one of life's simplest pleasures. Now, I know a lot of people out there seem to think the smell of gasoline ain't great for your brain. They insist you're fritzing out all of your head circuitry with these evil airborne hydrocarbons, the equivalent of releasing a sack of rats into a restaurant kitchen or pouring a can of Coke into your laptop air vent. And you know what? Maybe they're right. I do fully agree that huffing gas fumes is really bad for you. That's really not debatable. But the regular old smell of gasoline just lingering around the fill-up station? I say the jury's still out on that one. Don't get me wrong. I have no idea why, when my dad pulled our old wood-paneled station wagon up to the Shell pumps, I loved to get out and take a giant sniff of that hot, gassy air. But I know I did. Maybe I felt a bit like a woodsman stepping out of his cabin, holding a cup of coffee. A baker pulling a tray of hot, buttery croissants from the oven, or a wine taster swirling a fat glass of Merlot before the big sniff. Maybe for a kid growing up in the suburbs, the smell of gasoline at the local pumps was the same sort of deal. Just one of those great smells of life. A smell that says something about who you are. Something about where you come from. Something about what you believe in. Awesome.
Your pillow. Back one day on a long road trip, I sat in the driver's seat. Ty sat shotgun and Chris sat in the back. We were trucking down a long stretch of Red Rocky Highway in New Mexico in silence when, out of nowhere, Ty suddenly turned to me and said, "Hey, how long have you had your pillow?" You kind of roll with the random questions on road trips. Because if you don't, you'll get mighty sick of I Spy and the four mixtapes you brought along pretty quick. So I thought about it for a moment, then said earnestly, "You know, I can't remember ever not having my pillow. I think I've had it for like 20 years or something. It's completely old, worn out, flat and stained. But I've had it forever and I can't find another good flat pillow like this. So I'll probably keep it until it disintegrates or until I lose it or something." I continued to stare straight ahead and fiddle with the radio, but Ty stared back at me completely horrified. His jaw dropped, his brain boggled, and he was silent for a minute. "You know," he started eventually, his eyebrows furrowed in real concern and his head bobbing in little nods, as if convincing himself that, despite the severity of the news he was about to deliver, it was important to just get it out. "You're not supposed to keep any pillow for longer than a year. It's actually really, really bad for you." "Whatever," I countered, eventually settling on a radio station. "It's just a pillow." "Yeah, that's the thing," Ty countered. "It's not just a pillow at that point. It's a really dense collection of years of dandruff, dead skin, dust mites, and drool. Seriously, it's less pillow and more your disgusting head at that point. It's full of years of bacteria. Bacteria that's had a chance to grow and build cities. I swear I saw it on the news." There was a pause before I eventually dismissed Ty's claim with finality. "Psh," I concluded, putting on my sunglasses and turning up the volume on the radio. Defeated, Ty let it go, preferring to let me suffer the nightmarish consequences of sleeping on my pillow rather than waste any more effort trying to convince me that I needed an upgrade. So we drove on in silence, watching the world go by on that long stretch of highway. I let it drift away then, let it disappear. But really, the truth is that I just didn't want to think about it. No, I didn't want to contemplate the possibility that I might need to replace my pillow. Because there's really nothing like the comfort provided by your pillow, is there? I'm talking about the one you sleep on every night. The one that has bent and shaped itself around your head, has been fluffed and squished and packed and flipped, It's a bit yellow, there's some hair on it, but it just knows you. It loves you. And it's been loving you 8 hours a day since you can remember. I once heard a stand-up comic describe his pillow as looking like a bandage from the Civil War. And mine's probably at that level, too. I even think of it as a bandage, cradling and caressing my worn, weary head, providing a gentle escape from reality every night from dusk till dawn. I mean, that's why I can't get a good night's sleep anywhere unless I take my pillow along. I admit it looks funny walking in the door with a pillow under my arm, but oh well. See, what if I sleep over at your place and you toss me one of those flimsy sack pillows that feel like they're stuffed with 50 ripped up handfuls of industrial grade styrofoam? And I'm not taking any chances with the hotel's puffy cloud pillows either. Or those whacked out ergonomic jobs that make your head feel like it's sitting on a wheelchair ramp. No, it's all about your pillow. Yours. Your pillow. I mean, have you ever tried to switch pillows with someone else one night? It cannot work. Your pillow's been there through the highs, the lows, the nightmares, the tears. You've gone through a lot together and you know each other so well. So, next time you're planning to crash somewhere, take your pillow. In exchange for a little less packing space, you'll get a lot more hours of late-night comfort and moonlit subconscious bliss. And hey, if you don't believe me, sleep on it. Awesome.
Getting something with actual handwriting on it in the mail. Checking the mail can be a bit depressing. Sometimes there isn't anything in there. Nope, nothing at all. Just one big, empty mailbox telling the world that everyone forgot about you today. Then again, the alternative is typically a fistful of bills and flyers. Someone's selling air conditioners, your car payment's due, and the pizza place down the street has a new crust. All nice to know, of course. Just kind of boring, kind of bland, kind of blah. But that's what makes it so great when something with actual handwriting on it turns up in the mailbox. Those little endangered parcels have something very special about them. For instance, feel that ink. If you're lucky enough to score a full-on letter, you know how good it feels to hold that pen-scratched masterpiece. Both sides of the paper are carved up and it sort of crisps and crinkles in your hand. That certain texture to it feels very real and honest, like the person who wrote it put a bit of themselves in that envelope and sent it over. If I were a tree, I like to think I'd be proud if my slaughtered pulpy remains were used for a letter like that. Seriously, it would bring a tear to my leaf. It smells. Sure, it may not smell too strong, but the occasional letter has a whiff of hand cream or perfume on it. And really anything's better than the smell of mass ironed flyer ink, especially if the ink's real cheap and powdery and flakes off in the paper folds. Then you get it on your pants and under your fingernails, and for what? So Visa could tell you about their new interest rate? The complete package. When you get a handwritten letter in the mail, it has a whole different look and feel to it. It's a complete package. It's a wedding thank you card in a small red envelope with a perfectly placed stamp on translucent tissue paper. Or it's the letter from your kid at camp with the smeared ink and mud stains on it. It's licked shut real tight. There's a spelling mistake in your address, and the letter is folded thick, causing the envelope to puff out at the seams. There's nothing like it. Because no two handwritten letters are the same. You know whoever wrote it spent a lot more time scrawling it out than you did reading it. And they wrote it just for you, in their personal handwriting with their pen and paper. And they paid to mail it to you. Lady, I don't care how small or cold your heart might be, you have to admit that's pretty cool. Of course, the biggest reason why getting something handwritten is fantastic is because it's so darned rare. For most of us, we're more likely to see Halley's Comet crash into Bigfoot while he's riding the Loch Ness Monster than to actually get a full-blown note from a friend. So I say, treasure those handwritten notes when you get them, if you get them. And if you don't, there's an easy way to start. Man, just send a couple. Awesome.
Building an amazing couch cushion fort. Building a family room stronghold is no joke. No, it's a kindergarten lesson in teamwork, trust, and the art of war. Follow these 6 steps to construct your domestic defense. Step 1. Clear and collect. Get the coffee table, throw rugs, and plastic toys out of the way and begin hunting for materials. Couch cushions are your obvious first targets, but pillows, sheets, and sleeping bags will be needed too. And I don't have to tell you that if your family just got a new fridge delivered, grab that giant cardboard box because your fort just got a den. Step 2. Main construction. Some people opt for the sleeping bag carpeting technique. Others move directly into building sturdy walls and laying down a roof. Wall possibilities include turning chairs and couches around, tipping coffee tables sideways, or just piling up cushions. As for the roof, carefully toss a few sheets over your castle walls and hold the corners down firmly with Trivial Pursuit boxes, barbells, or an iron. Step 3. Add-ons. Now it's time to ammo up. Your fort needs windows to spot your enemies, a secret back door getaway in case of surprise attacks, and plenty of flashlights to navigate this harsh carpet-burny terrain. Plus, don't forget a TV with Nintendo in the barracks for those long, lonely nights. Step 4. Hiding spaces. All forts should include several hiding spaces in case of surprise enemy break-ins. Plan a couple behind false wall cushions or underneath a pile of dirty blankets. These also serve as excellent jail cells where you can trap your victims, give them noogies, and force them to watch you play video games for 3 hours. Step 5. Rations. You will need a hidden pile of snacks to get through the day. See if you can make do with a pile of saltines, open cereal boxes, and warm cans of soda. Hey, we're at war here, people. Step 6. Finishing touches. Finally, it's time to add extra perks, like a talking doll doorbell, cardboard periscope, or wide strip of bubble wrap under the welcome mat for your intruder alert system. After that, you're pretty much done. Your family room fortress is a tall, plush tower of strength, and you can just crawl in to defend your cozy new confines. Cushion forts sure do give us a burst of creative energy on rainy days. We get to plan, design, build, and ultimately relax deep in the bowels of our secret sanctuaries. After all, it's nearly impossible for kids to get away from it all. Parents watch us in the backyard, take us on family trips, and leave us with a babysitter. Those amazing couch cushion forts serve as so much more. They're bat caves, weekends at the cottage, trips down south, and quiet alone time, all rolled up in a pile of stained cushions, old blankets, and big ideas in the middle of the room. Awesome.
Jim Payne. Believe it, folks, I went to the gym last year. Yes, flabby belly, spaghetti thin arms, bright white sneakers, and all. Though it may surprise you, I am not a walking, talking hulk of a man. No, I'm a scrawny knee push-ups kind of guy who spends more time taking sips of water, talking to the maintenance folks, and figuring out how the machines work than actually working out. I don't tone my pecs, blast my quads, or crush my delts. If my trip to the gym was a short film, it would be called stretching in sweatpants. But anyway, my trip to the gym. It was 8:45 a.m., and I was sipping some water, trying to figure out how the bench press worked, when a steady stream of spandex-clad seniors suddenly brisked by me with stern brows and folded towels draped over their shoulders. Honestly, you might have thought there was a sale on oatmeal, or a Wheel of Fortune marathon about to start at the back of the gym, because these grannies and grampies were on a mission. When I asked a couple maintenance guys what was going on, they told me boot camp was about to start. My mind immediately flashed to visions of crawling through muddy trenches in baggy camo, swinging over frothy rapids on jungle vines, and standing on the roof of a rusty beat-up car firing a machine gun into the sky with one hand. I can't explain these images, but they compelled me to follow the wrinkle march into the aerobics room. And I know I don't need to tell you what happened next. Large, adult-sized, Fisher-Price plastic and foam bits were strewn all over the floor. Thumping dance music started bumping over the speakers, and a headband-clad drill sergeant screamed the sweat out of us. Adrenaline racing, I stepped up, stepped down, and moved barbells all around. I kicked up, swung back, and prayed softly. After about 15 minutes, most of the old folks were barely sweating, while I was keeled over, my mouth sucking back dry, sweaty air, a sharp knife-like pain quietly stabbing my gut. And the whole time, Sergeant Purple Leg Warmers was barking at me to keep going. Don't stop. 2 more minutes. 1 more minute. And rotate! It was intense. By the end, I was a jello blob of hot muscles and shin splints. I felt like I'd fallen down 100 flights of stairs and landed in a construction site. I was in pain and agony. But you know what? It felt good. I felt like I made it. I felt like I did something. There was a tingling buzz of satisfaction burning in my shredded calves. A lingering ache of pride in the dirt bike tracks riding up my stomach for 3 days, and a quiet happiness with the gym pain I'd inflicted upon myself. When you reach up higher than you've reached before, give a little more than you gave before, and dig deep to your core and end up sprained and sore, well, around here we say that's a little something called awesome.
Squeezing through a door as it's shutting without touching it. Tiny squirts of adrenaline pump into your bloodstream when you pull off this classic move. Yes, suddenly you morph from guy walking to the subway after work into Indiana Jones in that scene where he slides under the wall at the last second. Your hands stay clean, your strut stays mean, and you zip through that closing door and don't look back, hoping it doesn't nail anybody in the face behind you. Awesome.
Snow days. Let's break it down a bit. Let's talk about the 3 main types of snow days. 1. The pre-planned snow day. Your town gets hit by an ice storm and 4 feet of heavy packing snow. It's going to take a couple days to dig out, so somebody makes the call to cancel school in advance. This is definitely a good snow day, but it zaps out all the anticipation. Worst of the 3 types. 2. The high probability snow day. This is where it's snowing hard and heavy the night before. There are reports of black ice and cars in the ditch. People hunker down by the window with hot cocoa and turn the radio on for weather updates. This is known as a high probability snow day. You're almost positive it's going to happen, so you go to sleep excited about getting up the next morning. And really, the night before is almost as fun as the snow day itself, because you're already planning the day in your head, putting off your homework and calling your friends. Of course, once in a while, the sun is mysteriously shining the next morning and the roads are clear. But this is very rare. 3. The surprise snow day. This here's the mighty king of snow days. This is where nobody suspects a thing the night before. Have some dinner. Do some homework. Brush some teeth. Yep, just a typical night around the house. But then, suddenly, the next morning, there's a firm knock on your bedroom door and it's your mom or dad telling you, it's a snow day. Now that's a body buzz for kids. Homework already out of the way, no risk of missing anything at school, it's time for an all-out, lie-back-and-relax, chill session with your friends. And the day really can't disappoint, because there were no expectations to begin with. You want to sit in the basement and play video games all afternoon? No problem. Build a snowman and shovel the driveways for cash? Sign me up. Construct elaborate forts for a massive neighborhood snowball fight? I'm in. Just be a kid and love it lots. And so, when it starts to get a bit chilly, let's all cross our fingers and hope for a good snow day season. Let's hope this isn't one of those winters where we put up a goose egg on the snow day category. No, I say, let's break the record. Let's go for 4 or 5 of the suckers. Hey, maybe 6 even. Let's get El Nino in on it. Because ladies and gentlemen, say it with me. If there's one thing we all know, it's that a snow day is a good day. Awesome.
The first time you fly alone. Flying can be scary. First of all, the airport's usually in a distant part of town you don't visit very often. Maybe you snake up a jammed freeway, take a special off-ramp, or ride the subway to a nearly off-the-map stop where you exit into a garage full of diesel fumes and shuttle buses. And when you get to the airport, it's not much easier. Digital boards flash departure times, arrows point in all directions, and winding lines lead to a mishmash of checkout counters. Custom forms need filling, bags need weighing, passports need checking, and boarding passes need printing. Toting your awkward handfuls of documents, papers, and suitcases, you pass bomb-sniffing dogs, security scans, and suitcase inspections. Then there's the separation anxiety that comes from watching your luggage disappear on a black rubber belt into a dark tunnel. It doesn't end there. Now there are gates to find and fuzzy announcements about delays and cancellations. As you double-check that you have all your forms and you're at the gate for New York, not New Delhi, you wonder if they called your name, if it's your turn to board, or if there will be enough space for your carry-on luggage when you find your seat. Flying can be scary. Now just remember the first time you did it all by yourself. That first time you fly alone is an exhilarating moment. So many things could go wrong. So when you're through with all the documents, checkpoints, and security, and finally on the plane, you're loving it lots. The flight takes off and the attendant sneaks you an extra snack as you tilt your seat back, let your eyelids droop. Smile and flash back at how far you've come. At how far you've come. You've come. You've come. You've come. Color-streaked, postcard-faded blurs, flash of tricycles giving way to bicycles, of you as a nervous 8-year-old under a big helmet getting the push-off and wobbling down the sidewalk. Your neighborhood opening up into a patchy jungle of parks and sidewalks to be explored. Too big for backyard britches, you teeter down to playgrounds and corner stores far, far away. Licking popsicles with friends, you find bugs, run up slides, and blow wide open your view of the world. Flash forward to the day you first realize you can drive. After stressful tests and nervous parents, you finally get the keys and explore your town with carefree recklessness. Distant streets and shopping malls all connect to the road you're on, and you smile as your hand slips out the window and the summer breeze whips your face. Burger joints across town are suddenly close by, and you cruise late at night eating fries with friends as your parents sit nervously in housecoats in front of a flickering TV, waiting for you to come home. The seatbelt sign dings on, and you open your eyes. As you tilt your seat up and glance out the window, just look at how far you've come. Jumbo jets whisk people from Seoul to Sydney to San Francisco as the entire world becomes your oyster. You feel free as you stare out the window and watch your city zoom out to patchy splotches of crisscrossed yellows and browns. The buzzy feeling of pride you get the first time you fly alone is an amazing sensation. It's a sense of growing up, a sense of growing older, and a sense of growing into a confident and capable person in charge of your own life. Awesome!
When you spill something on your shirt and it doesn't leave a stain. We've all been there. Mustard swirls drip from the back of the hot dog, coffee cups splash in the drive to work, and spoonfuls of lumpy ice cream go for a ride. Yes, we're all familiar with the classic day-long shirt stain, also known as the international symbol of clumsiness. Whether it's a samosa spill on your sari, a wasabi smear in your kimono, or an olive oil splash on your toga, we all know what that spill means, and that spill screams, you are messy. It's sad but true, folks. Kiss the job interview goodbye, end the first date early, and skip the toast at your daughter's wedding. It's all over now because you had your chance and you blew your chance. Guacamole smears in your tie and tomato squirts in your tux just trashed your night and trashed your mood. Yes, we've all been there. And none of us like stained shirts. But that's why it's so great when you just barely escape the stain. Yes, these drip-dodging miracles can happen one of three ways. One, the pick-me-up. That lumpy clump of ice cream skids off your stomach straight to the ground, leaving only a couple chocolate chips lying in your belly button dent. What a save. Just pick the chips up and you're golden. Two, the camouflage mirage. This is when the juicy beef drippings leaking out of the taco land squarely on a juicy beef dripping colored stripe on your clothes. Lucky break, because now you can enjoy the day being clumsy in camo. Three, the against all odds. Here's where you have absolutely no right to avoid the stain, but do so for mystical reasons that defy all logic. Somebody steals a perfect nacho off your plate and carelessly dumps its load on your sleeve, but somehow it just skis off gracefully onto the tablecloth. A full beer gets spilled and drips all over you, but some quick whisking blows it away and no harm done. We can't explain these, but they are true miracles. A big spill without a big stain means you played with fire and came out cool, hung over the edge but pulled yourself back, and nearly ended it all, but instead just ended up being awesome.
Finding the last item of your size at the store. It all starts with the hunt. Mall walking, clothes shopping, you're searching for cute tops or a new pair of jeans. You pop into stores, you do the figure eight walk around, you pop right out. You pinch fabrics, peek at wash instructions, and hold pants in front of mirrors, bending knees, biting lips, and flipping over price tags. Sure, everything's fine and everything's dandy. Until later in the afternoon when you're still empty-handed and your legs start burning and your boyfriend falls asleep on the man couch and you get really, 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 really thirsty. But you don't stop. Won't stop, can't stop the walking, just can't stop the shopping. So you keep going, keep plugging, keep trudging along. You keep moving, keep motoring, keep soldiering strong. No, you won't quit, won't split, won't call it a day. You won't run, won't ditch, till you find something and pay. So, you keep looking and looking until it finally comes, that moment where you spot a perfect top, glowing from the other side of the store. You hold your breath, run over to check, and the color looks good, the material looks good, the price looks good, the wash instructions look good, but do they have it in your size? Panic sets in as you begin frantically flipping through the hangers. Shoot! XXL, XXL, XXS, XXXL. Suddenly you start thinking you wasted the day. Your calves ache and your stomach rumbles as you ask yourself, did I survive 6 hours on a Snickers for nothing? But then, just as the worry is settling in, putting its feet up and getting comfortable, it finally happens. You find one. Clouds part. Sun shines, bugles blare, and angels sing as you somehow manage to score the absolute last item in your size at the store. Oh, you're buzzing free, and your brain flies as you enjoy one of three versions of this classic high. Version 1. Back of the rack. Just as you're getting bummed out by all the oddball sizes, you eventually find your perfect shape chilling out in the shadows at the back. Good find. Version 2. Lost in thread paradise. Employees struggle to keep restocking customer throwaways, so sometimes that perfect shirt gets lost in thread paradise. You discover it hanging with the wrong clothes, crunched in a ball in the change room, or lying on the counter behind the cashier. Good find. Version 3. Same solar system, different planet. This technically isn't the last of your size in the store, but it's still a classic. Here's where you curl up into a ball and start crying big snotty tears on the floor while pounding your fists into the ground until a friendly cashier calls a nearby store and has them hold one for you. Good find. And now you're laughing. You grab your bag, stretch your back, and walk the long walk back to the car. Sun setting over the parking lot, you feel energy, excitement, and accomplishment. Now the day feels productive and well spent. You got exercise, your boyfriend survived, and you came, you saw, and you conquered. Awesome.
When the boss goes out of town. Who's up for a 3-hour lunch?
Awesome.
Getting out of the car and stretching at the highway rest stop. I spy with my little eye something that starts with you. If you guessed uncomfortably long car trip, you got it, baby. Maybe you're in the backseat squeeze for hours, one leg on each side of the floor hump, bladder clenched tightly, holding on for dear life. Maybe you're in a blissful Game Boy cocoon, headphones in your ears, video game in your lap. Or maybe you're driving the boat, steering the ship, mind on the road, navigating steep curves and sharp swerves. Whatever your situation, it sure feels good when that hot, steaming car rolls to a slow stop off the highway. That's when you pop open the door and stretch like you've never stretched before. Arms out, arms up, way up to the sky. Just popping that back and twisting that neck in all directions while saying, "Oh!" a lot. Maybe squeeze onto your tippy toes and feel the burn rise up your legs, those cold, clenched muscles getting a hot slap wake-up call. Feel your hamstrings stretch long, stretch hard, and cry out with tears of joy as freedom rings again. Plus, you finally get to pee. Awesome.
Planning for snoozes. If you're like me, then a war is waged every morning near your alarm clock. It is a never-ending series of epic clashes between the awake you and the sleeping you, with each side sticking to its guns, fighting fiercely in the ultimate battle for the first half hour of your day. Sometimes, it seems like if it were up to our subconscious selves, a lot of us would be lazing around in a world of rumpled sheets and dreams all day. You know how it is. Maybe at night, you're a level-headed gal with a level-headed plan. I'll go for a quick jog tomorrow before work, you say to yourself. Maybe whip up some oatmeal afterward. But your groggy, bedheaded self just ruins everything the next day. Let's keep sleeping, she convincingly suggests when the alarm goes off, hitting the snooze button on your behalf. See you in 9. I don't know about you, but until recently, I've been trying to deceive the sleeping me with the only two weapons I've got. One, moving the alarm clock to the other side of the room to give my waking self time to get its act together. And two, setting the time farther and farther ahead to try and trick my sleeping self into thinking it's making me late. But after years of playing the same game, it eventually happened. I hit a breaking point. I just couldn't do it anymore. So now, my new gig is trying to keep everybody happy. That's right. Keep snoozing in the picture and hold down a job at the same time. Folks, I'm talking about planning for snoozes. Adding them to the list. Budgeting them right in there. Finally giving them the credibility they've long aspired to and making them an official part of the day. So now I say, if you must get out of bed by 8 a.m., that's fine. Just set the alarm for 7:30 a.m. first. Throw your sleeping self a bone and hook it up with three solid snoozes. And you know what? You win too. Those 9 extra minutes can feel like hours, complete with vivid dreams and fresh drool on the pillow to show for it. You wake up refreshed, happy, and smiling. The best part comes later in the day, when anybody asks how you slept, because you know what to tell them. Awesome.
New Socks Day. Rip open the plastic wrap, slip off the hairpins, and peel off the sticky tape, because it's time for New Socks Day. Let the streamers fly down and the balloons rise up for this magical moment. Oh, New Socks Day is a terrific treat for your feet. We've talked before about how they got it bad. Toe knuckles get stubbed, dry skin gets rubbed, and bunions grow on your baby toe. Squeeze those caked and cracked pita bread heels into tight shoes all day and you'll soon agree. Your feet deserve to be treated like royalty. On New Socks Day, feet aren't forgotten warriors clad in an unprotective armor of dry skin and old socks. No, they're queens cloaked in royal gowns, bathed in soft cotton, and tenderly hugged in factory-fresh fabric. Also, let's not forget the slip and slide. New socks grease your feet and let you move with reckless abandon across the hardwood floors of this great land. They let kids dream big dreams of futuristic frictionless worlds. No New Socks Day chats are complete without discussing that high-quality toe jam. What's more satisfying than picking out those furry chunks at the end of the day? When I do the deed, I pretend I'm the world's greatest surgeon, wearing baby blue scrubs, leaning over a sliced open stomach under bright white spotlights in the middle of a tense operating room. And then, in a dramatic moment, I just start lifting out bloody pliers again and again, yanking out glass shard after glass shard, as everybody in the viewing gallery jumps to their feet and erupts in cheers. Could be just me, though. Hey, now listen. All socks eventually get old. Tiny holes grow, heels brown and yellow, and elastics fray and rip away. One day you'll hold a warm sock up from the dryer and wonder if your washing machine's busted. That's when you know the dream is over, and it's time to go shopping. New Socks Day is the start of that clean dream. It's the beginning of your new life together. Awesome.
Watching your odometer click over a major milestone. When your bucket of bolts clicks over a major milestone, you can't help but smile and feel proud. "We made it, Rusty Lady!" you say out loud, slapping the dash and honking the horn as you sit jammed in the fast food drive-through. "Happy birthday, old highway roller. Never thought we'd get this far." And isn't it true? When your car clicks over a big round number, it sure is a special day. After all, assuming you cruise an average of 15,000 clicks a year, you only achieve this major accomplishment once every 5 or 6 calendar turns. That's reason enough to celebrate. I'm guessing you probably saw it coming for a while, too. Maybe you were grabbing groceries or dropping the kids off at daycare last month when a 99,398 caught your eye, or a 198,881 made you do a double take. And maybe you made a mental note to get ready. Maybe you wondered where you'd be when the big day came. Maybe you bought a dress. If so, I certainly don't blame you, because when your Rust Bucket's clicker counter snaps into new territory, it's like she's suddenly all growed up. You smile slowly and breathe in fried chicken and gas fumes as your mind rushes back to great times you've shared over the years. The day you first realized you could drive, locking people out of your car and pretending to drive away, and hanging your hand out her window on lazy summer afternoons. Yes, watching your odometer click over a major milestone is a great feeling. Congratulations on being there for the big day. Awesome.
Mastering the art of the all-you-can-eat buffet. Munch lunch at a Chinese restaurant, brunch at a Holiday Inn, or dinner at a wedding reception, and chances are good you will come face to face with the all-you-can-eat buffet. If you're a buffet amateur like me, your pupils dilate and your mouth starts watering as soon as you spot the long table full of steam trays and crisscrossed tablecloths. Soon it's game on, and you grab a plate and pile it high with some bread, a few salads, a couple rolled up salamis, and a bowl of wonton soup. For plate number two, you tackle the main course, scooping up sticky heaps of kung pao chicken, soggy French toast, or paper-thin slices of roast beef soaked in dark mushroom gravy. Then you go back for a third plate, this one featuring a tipsy mountain of desserts, maybe some assorted squares, a gummy slice of cheesecake, or fluorescent pink freezer-burned ice cream sliding around your plate. Then, as you lie bloated on your chair, your buttons bursting, your eyelids drooping, you face a final decision. Do you go back for the fourth plate? The fourth plate is almost always a good idea before you do it, and a bad idea afterward. It's the helping after the helping after. It's the greatest hits plate, a star-studded collection with the most popular items coming together for the reunion tour, the last hurrah, the final dance at the dinner table. The fourth plate is also a famous mark of a buffet amateur, because it can be the sign of someone who realizes that the second plate was the best, and they really just want more of the second plate. For years, I scarfed down the fourth plate at the Indian buffet near my college. Buttery, pillowy, soft naans piled high, thick and creamy butter chicken, and spicy simmering lamb in a hearty broth. It was just too much. I caved in every time and walked away with a curry-busting gut and a samosa hangover. Since then, I've been tutored on the art of mastering the all-you-can-eat buffet. Everybody's got their own techniques, but here's what I've learned over the years. 1. The walkthrough. Don't do what I used to do and blindly take a spoonful of everything. No. You've got to do your walkthrough first. You're a detective, popping open steam tray after steam tray, looking for recent fill-ups, traffic around popular items, and sure winners like omelet stations or a guy in a chef's hat slicing big slabs of meat. Now's also time for some belly space analysis, where every item's tasty deliciousness is weighed against its projected stomach volume. Bread, soup, and salad rarely pass the belly space analysis test. Skipping those means you just gained an extra plate and are on your way. 2. Drink later. Sugary drinks fill you up with carbs and cost extra. If you can postpone your Pepsi, you'll save space for the hot goods. 3. The sampler. My dad is famous for the sampler plate. Within minutes of arriving, he'll dot a big white plate with small portions of every entree and proceed to say, a lot, while scooping up tiny forkfuls of each to see what will make the cut. You have to have willpower to pull off the sampler, but it can be very rewarding. You know you aced it when your next plate is just piles of your two favorites. Good on you. 4. Staggered trips. If you're with friends, don't wait until everybody finishes their first plate before uniformly filing up for a second trip together. No, go separately and act as each other's eyes and ears out there. What's new? What's hot? What's fresh? What's not? Your friends are doing their job when you see them running back to the table to scream, "They just brought out more coconut shrimp!" Also, be sure to designate someone at your table as the lookout. This person should have a clear view of the buffet and raise the alarm whenever they see someone coming from the kitchen with a new steam tray. 5. Big plates always. Be watchful of the small salad and dessert plates lurking about. Find your secret stash of full-size dinner plates and use them. Know them, love them lots. The big plates will let you spread your meal around and avoid piling things high, which generally results in meat gravy getting all over your Caesar salad. 6. One more egg roll. When the check arrives, take your time. Slow it right down and see who still has room. Since you've been so busy scarfing your food and staggering trips, now really is the best chance to catch up with your friends. Then, after 10 or 15 minutes, someone will likely cave in and say, "Okay, one more egg roll. This is buffet victory." With these tips, plus your personal experiences, you too can master the art of the all-you-can-eat buffet. After that, there's really no stopping you. So eat all you can, my friend. Eat all you can. Awesome.
Finding money in your old coat pocket. My old roommate was sifting through and tossing out some old birthday cards once when a crisply entombed $20 bill slid out of a faded card from Grandma. Her eyebrows perked up, her mouth formed a perfect O, and she raised her hand up top for a high five, which I promptly delivered. Finding 10 bucks zipped up in last year's ski jacket, lying wet and crumpled in the washing machine, or folded in the pocket of your booze-smelling blazer is such a great high. There may be no such thing as a free lunch, but this sure comes close. Finding your own money is a lot like discovering an entirely new currency, one that cannot be used to pay down debts or obligations, but only has value when purchasing things you probably don't need and wouldn't have bought otherwise, like an old-school beanie cap, novelty 10-pound Toblerone bar, or high-octane gasoline. It is disposable income in the truest sense of the phrase. For the pessimists out there, you may be saying,
"Bruff, that money has been all chewed up by time and inflation, slowly losing value and unaccumulating interest while prices ramp right on up, making my life less and less affordable. That found money could have purchased more before I lost it than it can today, so why should I celebrate my own stupidity?"
But Pessy, come on. We're talking about found money here. Money that hasn't been budgeted for, accounted for, remembered for, promised for, or owed for anything at all since you lost it. Surely the few sacrificed cents of interest in the bank are a small price to pay for holding that folded-up bill right up to the sky in your tightly clenched fist with no claims to satisfy. Sure, it may smell a bit like mothballs, Tide, or Grandma's skin cream, but that money still works, and it works well. So let's call found money what it really is then. Awesome.
The Laugh Echo. While sitting around the lunch table in 10th grade, my friend Mike accidentally squirted himself in the face with the juice box. He thought it was empty and squeezed the daylights out of the thing, causing streams of apple juice to drench him completely. His hair soaked, his eyebrows dripping, his mouth slowly and painfully dropped into a perfect O of shock, while everybody around him rolled with laughter. For years after that, whenever that crystal-clear image of Mike's sticky, juicy, and surprised face suddenly popped into my head, I burst out laughing. I just couldn't help it. I had a laugh echo. Yes, the laugh echo is when you laugh out loud after suddenly remembering something funny that happened a while ago. It's a random and hilarious event that can occur with family, with friends, or, for bonus points, when you're by yourself in a crowded public place. Now, laughing really is great for us. Yes, it helps protect our heart, lowers our blood sugar after a meal, helps us sleep, juices up our antibodies and blood flow, and gives us mini cardio workouts throughout the day. Honestly, have you ever seen babies just laughing uncontrollably for no reason? They know the score, and are probably just remembering something funny that happened in the womb. Folks, you know it, and I know it. We can learn much from the baby. So next time you let out a big laugh echo in public, just love it lots. Because life's too short, my friends. Let's squeeze in as many laughs as we can get. Then at the end, when we're old and gray, when our bones are brittle and our hair is hay, how will it feel when we look each other straight in the eyes and burst out laughing? I think we both know the answer to that. Awesome.
Crying. A study in Scientific American Mind magazine said that on average, men cry X times a month and women cry Y times a month. Take a guess on the numbers and see how close you are. Answers are coming. Now, whether you're above or below average, consider crying a little bit more. When you feel the hot, salty tears coming, don't hold back. Let them flood your eyes and pour down your cheeks. Because hear me out. Share the tears. Crying brings us closer together. In these anonymous days of gated communities, big box stores, and rampant interneting, sometimes people just need the attention and care of a friend. I mean, when you see your pal crying, what happens? Maybe your eyes well up and you throw them a hug. And maybe that's exactly what they need and why the tears poured out in the first place. Body buzz. Studies show that emotional crying versus onion crying or eyelash in your eye crying actually releases a bunch of wacky hormones that relieve tension by balancing your body's stress levels. If you've ever said, "I'm okay, I had a good cry," then it could be because crying helps straighten out your chemically crooked self right when you need it most. And let's face it, that's a lot better than holding it in and shorting out your inner gearworks. I'm trying to tell you something. Babies cry before they talk to let us all know when they're tired, frustrated, scared, in pain, or when they really, really, really want their video back on. The point is that crying is a primal, universal way to communicate and tell us when something's up. Yes, even though men cry only once a month on average, and women let them pour five times or more, There's room for tears plus people. So don't hold back because you think it's embarrassing or a sign of weakness. No. When memories of lost loved ones flood back, painful experiences hit your heart or your heart swells up inside you, I say just let those big wet tears rain down without any guilt or shame. Because we all need to let go sometimes. Awesome.
Driving through your old neighborhood and stopping to see the house you grew up in. When my friends Chris Ty and I went on our cross-country road trip in the spring of 2007, we managed to stop in the small, hardscrabble dirt town of Paris, Texas. In addition to visiting the Kimberly-Clark Diaper Factory, miniature Eiffel Tower, and famous Jesus and Cowboy Boot statue, Ty insisted we drive through his old neighborhood to see his old home. Pulling down curbless side streets on our way out of town, Ty was already in that cloudy, nostalgic dream before we even got to the place. "Sure is a lot shadier than I remember," he commented quietly. "Tree's a lot bigger." We pulled up to Ty's old house, and his eyes popped as his brain flash-flooded with piles of distant memories rushing back all at once. He got out of the car and started walking around the yard, slowly taking it all in. Because even though it was just a nailed-together stack of wood, bricks, and shingles to us, for Ty, it was so much more. And you know, there is something profound about driving through your old neighborhood and visiting an old home. Depending on the time and place, you might notice some strange things. Maybe you wonder if the new family discovered that the side fence door made a perfect backstop for pitching practice. Do they know if you hit a chalk square between the outermost boards, the tennis ball almost always bounces back to you? Maybe you notice somebody trimmed the old jaggedly sharp evergreen with the tiny rock-hard berries on it, which was always the best spot for hide-and-seek and the perfect burial ground for He-Man action figures when you moved on to Transformers. You remember the soft needles jabbing your forearms and dirt sticking to your elbows when you were down there at dusk, and you remember it was worth it. If you're bold enough to ring the doorbell or take a quick peek in the backyard, you might see a new glass door replacing the rusty screen one that always slammed and had that thin sliding metal lock that never lined up properly. Or maybe you notice the same wobbly patio stones that remind you of birthday parties spent eating hot dogs and playing frozen tag and bare feet on the dandelions and crabgrass. Photos flash and flip through your brain. Sun setting over the fence, everyone licking frosty popsicles. Mosquitoes coming out and buzzing in your ears. Oil stains from Dad's truck still dot the driveway, and the little handprints you made in the corner of the sidewalk still sit there. And you wonder, does the dog next door still bark when someone jumps in the pool? Did they still leave the Christmas lights on until late January? Did the kids dunk on the basketball net off the hood of the car? But whatever you wonder, whatever you see, it sure is a sweet head trip driving down those old roads leading to the home you grew up in. You smile and remember summer nights, holidays with your cousins, and couch cushion forts on Saturday mornings. Maybe you're lucky and your old home is close by, or maybe it's torn down or far away. But if you haven't done it in a while and can still pull it off, take that sweet Sunday cruise down memory lane. Awesome.
The last day of school. My friend Jason had a tradition. Every year on the last day of school, he'd stop on a bridge over the creek on his walk home, pop open his three-hole binders, and dump all his pen-scrawled notes and sticker-covered tests into the bubbling rapids below. Somehow the sight of the paper soaking up and smearing the ink before drowning and drifting away gave him the therapeutic closure he needed before summer officially began. Although not all of us celebrated by polluting local waterways, The last day of school always had so much meaning. I don't know about you, but our school board didn't spring for air conditioning, figuring we could make it through a few hot weeks before the break. So as the cold winter thawed into muggy summer days, the heat and sweat just sank and stank, despite